You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This weekend at the Golden Globes, actress Meryl Streep made a highly provocative speech in which she urged the public, and more specifically her fellow performers, to confront and oppose the incoming Trump administration using their voices and their art.
Disrespect invites disrespect. Violence incites violence. As my friend, the dear departed Princess Leia, said to me once, take your broken heart, make it into art.
So, will they? And is art an effective means of building resistance and facilitating political change? Joining me today to talk about the future of protest and the role of the arts in politics are Khadija White, Assistant Professor of Journalism and Media Studies at Rutgers University, Art Spiegelman, artist, illustrator, and creator of the graphic memoir Mouse, and Stephanie Ibarra, Director of Special Artistic Projects for the Public Theater. Welcome to you all.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, folks, was that an effective speech? And if so, why? Khadija?
In terms of kind of getting the word out there about, you know, pushing back against this election, against this presidency, I think for sure it got a response from the president-elect for certain.
How about you, Art? What do you think?
Yeah, this is about all I can imagine anybody effectively doing yesterday, you know, is irritating our troll-in-chief or whatever you want to call him. And that's useful, and it's useful to remind people that people are not okay with this. I think that's the main thing that has to be kept front and center over the next few years, that it's not a matter of normalizing our relationship with the president, but that everybody in every field needs to explain that this is a major moment of devolution.
Stephanie, what do you think? Did you hear Meryl Streep's speech, and did you find it effective?
I found it extremely effective. It gave me goosebumps. And I also had a moment where I was like, oh, yeah, thank you for reminding us all what we should be doing anyway. You know, I feel like the arts and culture, and particularly storytellers like us in the theater, we always have a responsibility to be, you know, amplifying the voices of other and humanizing the stories of those who are not like us, and putting them in the foreground. So I really appreciated her, you know, sort of taking us all to task and reminding us all of what we're here to do.
Art Spiegelman, what is the challenge, do you think? What's the challenge for artists at this moment in American history?
Well, I have a very specific subset of being an artist at this moment in history by being a cartoonist. And one of the dilemmas I'm really genuinely trying to solve is how one can bring down a narcissist of these proportions, because all publicity is good publicity in this man's head. If he's attacked, he gets to gleefully attack back from the safety of his Twitter bunker. He gets to express outrage. He gets to lie about what was said. If you praise him, he beams and echoes it and goes on victory tours. And it makes it very hard to, on the surface at least, sink this ship. And I think sinking this ship is so necessary. So the problem for me is, how does one do this using cartoons, which tend happily to be these powerful negative force that gets deep inside your brains in a way that will, I think the best I can do, and maybe this works for theater and for even journalism if that's an art form, is to give comfort to those who are aware of how far off course we've gone, and give them the courage to stay the course. And that means, unfortunately, speaking inside our bubble, our particular false news bubble rather than theirs.
Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. What became clear to me over this past period is, when I first heard the word post-truth, I giggled as it seemed like a very academic term. Now it just seems like, yes, that's about what we're living through. There's the false news intentionally created to be clicked on Facebook as dollar bait for the people who've set it up. There's also the false news of what we were living in a kind of self-delusion in our nice blue bubble before the election, with only one route for Trump to win, and that one highly unlikely, that only even got vaguely pierced for me when I was giving a talk down in Lubbock, Texas, and saw, you know, my bubble, their bubble, when I'm standing in the middle of the bubble, they're the same size. Who's to say which one is bigger? They're as convinced that I don't know, Hillary is responsible for Benghazi and killed Foster and so on, as I am of my truths. And they don't meet. This gets complicated and reverberated on the web, and it becomes very hard to know what's true. But it's just as true on our side. Like the Washington Post seemed as, and the New York Times seemed as off as anything I was reading on Breitbart, and I was making myself read those things because I needed to know my enemy.
Hi, this is Arun Venugopal. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopez today. We're talking about the role of art in opposing and confronting politics and the incoming Trump administration. I'm speaking with Art Spiegelman, Stephanie Ibarra of the Public Theater, and Khadija White at Rutgers University. Stephanie, you're at the Public Theater. Tell me about what you all have planned. What is theater doing at this moment?
Well, at the Public Theater, happily, we've been doing this for decades, but I think it's even more important now to create spaces for conversation. I think that, you know, we serve an incredibly diverse audience at the Public. They come from all over New York City and all over the country in some cases. And so I do think that we're always striking the balance of how do we sort of preach to the choir, so to speak, preach to the converted, and also actively explore mentalities, experiences that are not our own. So it works both ways on our stages. In particular, the public forum program that I co-lead with Michael Friedman at the Public, we are, you know, rapidly responding to our current political climate and really trying to be deliberate about the conversations, carving out conversations in the next few months. Specifically, we have later on in this month, we're partnering with the Center for Constitutional Rights and with WNYC Green Space to around the Ziegler v. Abbasi Supreme Court case. It's going to be heard, I think it's next week, maybe?
Why don't you just, in that court case, which I know something about, but why don't you explain what that court case is about?
Well, generally speaking, it's about the illegal detention of Muslims after 9/11. And this particular piece that we're doing focuses on two brothers who were detained in Brooklyn for upwards of 8 months. And illegally, allegedly. And so the piece that we're doing, or the event that we're creating, will piece together letters from between these brothers that were written back and forth while they were being detained. And then we're going to have a conversation afterwards that focuses on accountability in our backyard, in a grassroots level, and accountability all the way up the food chain to the kind of highest leaders of our land. And how do we sort of hold everybody's feet to the fire.
Khadija, have the arts and artists themselves, have they traditionally had a significant role in shaping political opinion and in supporting and inspiring protest, or is it something we just, is a more contemporary sort of a paradigm?
No, absolutely. Art has always been kind of crucial. I mean, social movements happen when official channels fail groups of people, and art is really a perfect way to really fill that gap. I like to think, you know, at this moment, I like to think that this country is going back to its roots with Trump, right? This kind of full-on embrace of the rule of the wealthy white man. And so part of me wants to go back and say, well, how did we travel from that period? How did art and culture help us to progress? And I think about the role of the theater, music and paintings and literature played during abolition and during Jim Crow, you know, books like Madame Bovary and Uncle Tom's Cabin, paintings that depicted the horrors of slavery. Those all really helped shake up conversations and change people's ideas about the world. And I think that's what we'll see more of now. We have to. And of course, there's always, you know, the Black Arts Movement that really advanced the notion that, you know, in order to be real people, you have to see oneself in order to get free, in order to inspire, in order to push people forward. And I think if you talk to anyone from that period who kind of marched, they'll talk to you about the songs and they'll talk to you about the music. So absolutely, you know, I think the idea is that there is no movement without art.
All right. So help me, I guess, understand what seems to be a paradox. You have on one hand this assumption that artists, elites like Meryl Streep or visual artists, say, in New York, would more likely than not be liberal and would oppose a President Trump. At the same time, they are seen as a class, as elites, and as wealthy, and they're very powerful. So how do we reconcile these contradictions, Khadija?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a contradiction, really. I mean, artists are artists, right? I mean, they're wealthy artists, but they're also artists that are not wealthy, and they're all kind of doing the same work right now to create opposition. And there's a long legacy of it that precedes Meryl Streep. I've been quite shocked at this notion that it's outrageous for an artist to be political. I mean, it's saddened me that we've reached that point where people actually believe that art is not political. You know, Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes, Nina Simone, Paul Robeson, Sonia Sanchez, Audre Lorde. I mean, there was almost no political movement without artists that I can kind of track back. And so, you know, to present this idea that art should not be political, or that an artist who is wealthy should somehow then not speak their politics is outrageous. I mean, it shows us where we are at this moment, and it's something we should move beyond.
I guess part of this conversation has to do with one of the divides which I'm seeing on the left in the wake of the election, which is this debate which is happening over whether to reach across the aisle, to bring more people under the tent, so to speak, or to dig in and try to mobilize the people who already agree with you. Stephanie, what do you think is the goal?
I think we have to do both, frankly. I mean, I think that I think that there are artists, so many artists who are political, and also there's sort of subversive political acts that happen inside of our arts and culture spaces every day that don't have to look like the fist raised to the air, but that can also be about, you know, that kind of radical inclusion of all thoughts, people, shapes, sizes in one space and inviting discourse. And I know certainly in my corner of the world, in Off-Broadway at the Public Theater, that is the ultimate goal, is to build the tent big enough for everybody to live under and to invite the dialogue, because without that, without the crosstalk, we're not going to move forward, I don't think, as quickly as we could.
What about you, Art? Go ahead.
Well, my wife and daughter have just printed this amazing thing, which is called Resist. 50,000 at this point copies on newsprint of a free giveaway cartoon newspaper that was a gleam in the eye a month ago, is printed as of yesterday, and will be circulated at various sister marches as well as down in Washington and everywhere. And it was a very open call, and it includes highly known cartoonists as well as 13-year-old kids, as well as mostly women, but there's a man cave corner that I'd lobbied for so I could be in the issue. And what this is it's a way to see where people are actually at, because it was a very loose kind of editorial guidance to make sure that transgendered people were represented, for example, as well as all of the rainbow colors we've got. And the differences between the voices was part of what makes this newspaper so amazing, and what has made the response to it, when it was just an open call on the internet a month ago for contributions, happen. One thing that was interesting was the difference between the way male cartoonists and female cartoonists in general, although there are exceptions on both sides, tended to represent the issue. Like for men, drawings of Trump, including in my case, of one kind or another, predominated. For women, it was more about talking to their children, to their spouses of one kind or another, to themselves, about what they're going through as a result of this horrible, shocking blow that was the election. So to have that spectrum, there's about, I don't know, 100-plus cartoonists and illustrators in 40 pages, making everything from posters to rather inward-directed comics and graphics. And the result is you feel the voice that are gathering together for protest, and it's kind of moving in its aggregate now that cartooning is more of a general vernacular language than it was, say, 25 years ago, where you had to put in your apprenticeship on a newspaper to get anything to happen. So I think it's a sign of where we're at and what has to happen in my particular sub-corner of the sub-arts.
And can I just throw in, this is Khadijah, I just want to add that we need the folks raising their fists in the air just like we need in the air, just like we need Meryl Streep in an evening gown in a ballroom, you know. And I want us to all remember, you know, let's not pretend there are no risks here. The Dixie Chicks saw, you know, what kind of risks are there when you stand up for something that you think is right. And so all of these artists who kind of stand up and say something political, you know, they're doing what art, in my opinion, should do. The best art that we've seen, that we remember, is political art, and they're all taking a risk.
I'm speaking with Khadijah White, Stephanie Ibarra, and Art Spiegelman about how art can fuel political dissent. I'm Arun Venugopal in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, and we'll be back with more after a break. This is Arun Venugopal sitting in for Leonard Lopate. In regards to art and its ability to oppose, to resist, I do wonder, there is a lot of art in the world today. There's a lot of visual stimulus. There's a lot of distractions, content, as they call it now. Is the task of the political artist a lot harder these days, Art?
Gee, I think that one thing I'd like to point toward first, which is part of the answer, which is, yeah, fists raised is part of the story, especially when somebody feels like raising their fist. But back in the day, Vermeer's paintings were not overtly political, but they can be read that way as one looks at the maps in the background. And when I read a book called Vermeer in Bosnia, where the head of the war crimes tribunal would wander over from The Hague to look at some Vermeer paintings to give him strength to continue, that this isn't a matter of trying to mobilize all artists to make overtly and obviously political art. It's asking artists to be the antenna. And that can mean making something that doesn't even appear like political art, although it's important to let the obvious political artists find voices and move forward. One thing that comes to mind from work I've been involved in is my wife and I did a cover for The New Yorker back on September 14th, 2001. There was a black-on-black cover of the Phantom Ghost of the Towers on a black field. And that image has burned itself into many people's heads, this phantom limb of the tower being struck down. It wasn't a cry for war. It wasn't a cry for anything except a cry. And that cry managed to make The New Yorker much more central in the debates that have followed since, in the years since. And it is an image that seems to be a touchstone for many, many, many people as art made at that moment. And I think it's a matter of the artist actually functioning as an antennae rather than as an outgrowth of the fashion industry, which is what's happened in the upper echelons of art controlled by the 0.01% collectors who even found their way into the Trump cabinet. So I'm asking for a broader spectrum. And I've seen it at work. I don't want to hold the floor. There's a lot of people with a lot of things to say. But I just finished a book about an unknown artist named Cy Liu, an unknown now, who turned his back on the art world to pursue what he wanted to make. But in the 1940s, when he was at the front in a special ops secret force on the European theater, and after, when he was at Buchenwald, when it was first opened as part of a group called the Ritchie Boys, of GIs used for their German language skills, did a book called The Parade. It was overtly political, but not about just the moment he had lived through, born at, right at the end of World War I and lived through World War II very, in a very painful way, coming out with lots of physical and mental wounds, did a book telling the story of the perennial re-rising of war in every generation is somehow attractive. And it's a very powerful statement. When it was shown in a gallery in the post-war years, Albert Einstein wrote him a fan letter saying, you can't force an artist to be political, but when an artist who is political on some level allows full voice to that, one has to only, like, applaud. So this book, The Parade, got Einstein to say, our world needs you and your art. And then he compared it to Daumier and to Jonathan Swift in a different field as something that was an urgent statement that should be attended to. And when we were bringing it back now and reprinting it, it seemed like this really is more urgent now than ever, this particular work made in the 1945 to 1953 period that talks about something perennial and repeated and ends with a mother embracing a child who survived the war. Which leads me to parenthetically say, when I was talking to this old, old man, 98 when he died, a few months before he died, saying, so are you for Bernie or are you for Hillary? And he said, well, Bernie. Bernie seems like a very smart man, but I'm for Hillary, of course. And then I, who wasn't happy with Hillary until she was the main alternative, and embraced that cause then, he said, for Hillary, of course. And I said, why? I thought you said you were to the left of Karl Marx. He said, yes, Art, but unless we become a matriarchy, we have no future as a race.
Khadija, what do you think? This question of, like, how does art stand out? How does it command attention and be more than just a momentary sort of distraction or entertainment and actually seize the conversation? Is it harder these days?
Yeah, well, I mean, can we step back for a second? Because I feel like part of the question is not just what does art do, right? But what is the value of art to the movement, right? And what is the value of art to any social movement? When I was a journalist at PBS, I did a shoot with Danny Glover, and he told us about being a youth in California when Amiri Baraka shows up and is recruiting people to be in his play and says, all you so-called radicals need to come down. And, you know, if you're really radical, you need to come down and you need to try out for my play. And this is how Danny Glover enters acting. And that to me, that's a great story because it reminds me of this moment in which people understood art as essential to movement building, right? Not just a compliment, but its actual heart, the thing that inspires, it provokes, it mobilizes people. These people coming together to not just work and struggle for a new world, but actually to kind of create it and to visualize it and to let people see all of the things that they were imagining. And so for me, it's not just a question of, you know, what is the artist or what does the artist do or how is the artist political, but really what is art to movement building? What is art to advancing a cause? And I think we see really lots of times in history where this is true and where this is necessary.
I love what you're saying, Khadija, about the role of art in movement and it makes me think too of, in art, what you're saying about the subversive act of art. And I'm always thinking these days about the subversive kinds of storytelling, the stories that get revealed. We just did the show at the Public about the Black Panthers around their 50th anniversary. And one of my favorite, called Party People, and one of my favorite components of the show was the part where it sort of reminded and revealed to audiences that this was not just a group of militant people armed with guns, right? There was a very sophisticated network of communities feeding their own and teaching their own and caring for their children. And so even the act of revealing parts of stories that get defanged or hidden from us, I feel like is part of the role of the arts. When we hear about Rosa Parks and she got tired and she sat down. No, she was trained. It was organized. There was a plan there. And sort of pulling back the curtain on stories like that and also conjuring our own future, imagining what will come next, I think is the central role of art, and not just now. And I feel like we're having this conversation now and we talk a lot about the next 4 years, but if we're really doing it right, you know, we just sort of all woke up and we need to think way past the next 4 years, and we need to be like continuing these conversations and rigorously examining what kinds of stories we're telling them and what kinds of stories we're telling and who is telling them for decades to come.
Absolutely. And to get back at, what Art was saying earlier about this post-truth moment, you know, I study media and politics, and one of the things that we know, one thing about media and politics and art, and because I like to think of art in media and politics, one of the things we know is that a lot of what people learn about race and about people from other racial groups comes from what they see in television, film, and other media. But the other thing is that for those of us who study persuasion, you know, and I've learned this from the scholar Kathleen Hall Jameson, that the best way to convince someone something that they don't believe is to make them argue for that side. And so, you know, thinking about in this post-truth era, the way that art pushes someone to see through another person's eyes, right? It's a way to kind of fight hate. It creates a sentimental connection. It humanizes people in different circumstances and backgrounds, and it helps make the political stakes clear in a way that you really feel, you know? And I think in the quote-unquote post-truth era, this is really an important move that art can make. In the film Moonlight, I think, you know, it got a nomination. It won this past Sunday. The film Moonlight is a really good example of that, of really allowing people to see through someone else's eyes and experiences.
I agree that that's like probably the most important function of art. And the problem with the raised fist is it usually gets a raised fist back. The power of saying something that you really feel and know to be true and letting that be what you express is going to rally people around you. And in the world of television, which probably has a far greater outreach than theater, books, or for the most part cartoons, the world that came into existence with Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert was really both an important source of solace and of real news, people being better informed from those comedy shows than they were from the Fox News network. It seemed even tests of what people's knowledge was after consuming that diet. And yet, all of these things have odd unexpected consequences, so that I think I read, and I think it's true, but I may have read it on a false news click, that either Stewart or Colbert was talking about how what we're experiencing now with false news is a kind of blowback and a possible result of having fictionalized our news. Maybe news was always fictionalized, I don't know. But at that point, the next logical step is to make up stories that are funny from the right, or not funny, but equally, in quotes, credible to the gullible. And how does one navigate through this? And it may not be through the most obvious routes of countering one bubble fact with another bubble fact, but maybe with keeping your eye on the prize. What's important? Community is important. Allowing people to come together across class and racial divides is important. Sharing one's experiences is important. I didn't make Mao's as a political act, but I know that it's being found even more useful than ever in a world where I've used cat and mouse masks to represent Nazis and Jews, because it's easy to get past the masks to real people dealing with a story that I told because it was a real story weighing on me, my life with my father, an Auschwitz survivor. And the result of it was not getting lost in making it feel like history, but making it feel like lived daily life of interviews with a father I couldn't get along with about what he had lived through. And it makes it seem just as true now, whether you lift up a mouse mask and see a black face and lift up the cap mask and see and what they're calling an alt-right neo-Nazi. All of these are strategies that allow one to move towards something. And I believe that things like the transgender show, Orange is the New Black, going all the way back to, forgive me for mentioning his name out loud in the current environment, Bill Cosby show, helps people feel comfortable with the other.
This is Arun Venugopal sitting in for Leonard Lope today. Stephanie, the public theater has flags, right, outside, stating the theater's mission. Do you have any idea what's actually on those flags?
Yeah, so our core values are we're artist-driven, we are radically inclusive, and we have Shakespeare in the Park, which is free for all, so fundamentally democratic. And the thing that is on my mind most these days is that radically inclusive part. Like, that strikes at the heart, I think, of everything that we do, and it feels like the right battle cry, but is also a value statement. And in all of our work, whether it's, you know, the work we're doing, the stories we're telling on our stages, or our public works program, which, you know, sort of mashes up professional performers with community ensemble members, or a mobile unit, which takes free Shakespeare into prisons and homeless shelters and community centers, that all of it is an attempt to do that thing of building the big tent. For everybody to live under, but I think that we are getting even more sort of rigorous in how we define what else is radical. How can we be even more radically inclusive?
Could I ask you and Khadijah about the Women's March that's coming up on the 21st? It took me a long time to understand that it wasn't only for women to go, so I couldn't just happily stay home and draw while my wife and daughter went down to Washington. And it came up by accident where I was on a panel and somebody gets up and says, when we go down to Washington, we... And I said, wait a minute, it's a women's march, isn't it? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I didn't know I was invited. And he said, but now everybody, women means everybody. And I thought that was both hilarious and touching, because we're talking about bringing communities together. And although women's issues need to be at the front, especially after the dream of breaking a glass ceiling and having a woman president and the threat we seem to be under so directly of Planned Parenthood under attack and on and on and on, that I understand the primacy and importance of a woman's march, but I swear I didn't understand that I was invited. And now I, you know, hearing this both funny and accurate notion of, but women means everybody, was liberating for me, because for centuries and centuries, when we talked about mankind, we were subsetting women as part of that, and flipping that was really interesting for me.
Khadija, do you want to respond to that?
And yet, just to finish the thought, yeah. In today's Times, or yesterday's Times, I was reading about a social justice warrior telling a white woman who's going to the march on an email or whatever format it was that she should check her privilege, and her friends deciding not to go to the march. How do we make a big enough tent to have an impact and not create the kind of divisions that have happened on the left from the Mensheviks versus the Trotskyites to the 60s movements of people being more...
So we are short on time, so Khadija, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I think Art just did a great job of laying out that there's a march coming up, and you know there's some really important conversations happening about how to keep everyone included and not to exclude certain people, and that's an important conversation that happened coming out of the you know the Pantsuits Nation debacle going online. So I hope everyone goes who's invested in that, and you know and that we keep having these conversations. But I do want to just kind of close out with, you know, this notion of raising fists, this notion of you know what kind of art is political art. We need it all, right? We need it all in order to move forward conversations. And I hope we keep thinking of journalism as an art because we need good storytelling for the time to come.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could just say, you know, further to your point, Art, about the artists being an antenna, beautifully across the country as we speak, there are theaters, community theaters, regional theaters, high school drama clubs in our own backyard, Broadway and off-Broadway are all doing just that and organizing under the auspices of the Ghostlight Project. So on January 19th, the eve of the inauguration, at 5:30 p.m. in each time zone, theaters across the country will gather outside of their buildings holding light and sort of inspired by the ghost light that comes on our stages every night after the show, after the curtain comes down. So we are all unified in this action of reaffirming that theater and the arts is a place of tolerance and solidarity and inclusion. So if you want to check out in your neighborhood which theaters are participating, you can visit theghostlightproject.com.
So we have to wrap it up. Anybody else participating in any marches next week? Art, are you participating in a rally sponsored by Penn next week?
Exactly. Thank you. I promised I would at least mention that on the steps of the New York Public Library this Sunday, more than 50 writers and artists have signed to read on the steps and then march in front of Trump's fortress to indicate what writers can do and are doing with people reading things they've written and things that are kind of canonical and seminal texts in the fight for free expression that's at the core of the Penn Project. And if you look it up on penn.org, Writers Resist New York City, you'll also find references to all of the satellite events taking place all across the country that writers are rallying for, knowing that we're living through an urgent moment.
Thank you very much, Art Spiegelman, Khadija White, and Stephanie Ibarra, for speaking to us about how art can fuel political dissent. You can find details of that rally on our show page. I'm Arun Venugopal in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.